Here, then, is Cross of Blindness, the speech that Dr. Tenbrook delivered on his birthday, July 6, 1957, to the 17th Convention of the National Federation of the Blind in New Orleans, Louisiana. We begin with the introduction to the speech that appears in Chapter 2 of our organizational history, Walking Alone and Marching Together. The symbolic cross he, bracket Dr. Tenbrook, close bracket, saw the blind bearing was the burden of social stigmas, stereotypes, and superstitions, the dead weight of public prejudice and misunderstanding. In a masterly speech, which has since become one of his most famous, Tenbrook spelled out in equally vivid terms both the case for and the case against self-organization by the blind. His address, delivered before a banquet audience of 700, stands as a memorial to the high ground, the peak of unity and confidence which was attained by the National Federation of the Blind in that watershed year. That high ground was soon to be lost in the turmoil of civil war and not to be reached again for years to come. But in 1957, the national movement of the organized blind, not yet a score of years old, appeared as firm in its solidarity as it was irresistible in its force, and no one who heard the leader of the movement speak that day could doubt that these newly independent and self-assertive people would forever refuse to bear the stigmatizing cross of blindness. Here is the full text of that speech. Cross of Blindness, an address delivered by Professor Jacobus Tenbrook, President, National Federation of the Blind, at the banquet of the annual convention, held in New Orleans, July 6, 1957. A photo appears at this point, the caption, Jacobus Tenbrook speaking at the podium.
In the short 17 years since our founding, we have grown from a handful of men and women scattered over seven states to a federation of 43 state affiliates. The first convention of the NFB in 1940 was attended by 12 or 15 persons. Our last convention, last year, July, had a registration of 705 coming from every corner of the Union. That's rapid organizational growth by any yardstick, considering the total blind population of the country and the difficulties in organization. Who are these people of the NFB? What is the purpose that has led them to self-organization in such numbers and unites them now with such apparent dedication and enthusiasm? It is not enough, I think, to answer that the members of the National Federation are drawn together by their common interest in the welfare of the blind, for many of the sighted share that too. Nor is it sufficient to say that we are united only because we are blind. Many who are affiliated with agencies for the blind have that characteristic also. It is fundamental to the uniqueness of our group that we are the only nationwide organization for the blind, which is also of the blind. The composition of the National Federation, indeed, is living testimony to the fact, unfortunately not yet accepted by society as a whole, that the blind are capable of self-organization, which is to say, of leading themselves, of directing their own destiny. Yet this is still only half the truth, only a part of the characteristic which defines our federation and provides its reason for being. Our real distinction from other organizations in the field of blind welfare lies in the social precepts and personal convictions which are the motive source of our activity and the wellsprings of our faith. The belief that we who are blind are normal human beings sets us sharply apart from other groups designed to aid the blind. We have all the typical and ordinary range of talents and techniques, attitudes and aspirations. Our underlying assumption is not, as it is with some other groups and agencies, the intrinsic helplessness and everlasting dependency of those who happen to lack sight, but rather their innate capacity to nullify and overrule this disability, to find their place in the community with much the same degree of success and failure to be found among the general population. Perhaps I can best document this thesis of the normality of the blind with a random sample of the occupations represented at our national convention held in San Francisco last year. Among the blind delegates in attendance, there were three blind physicists engaged in experimental work for the United States government. There was one blind chemist also doing experimental work for the national government. There were two university instructors of the rank of full professor, a number of other college instructors of various ranks, and several teachers of sighted students in primary and secondary grades in the public schools. There were 13 lawyers, most in private practice, two employed as attorneys by the United States government, one serving as the chairman of a state public service commission, one serving as a clerk to a state chief justice. There were three chiropractors, one osteopath, 10 secretaries, 17 factory workers, one shoemaker, one cab dispatcher, one bookmender, one repairman, four telephone switchboard operators, plus numerous businessmen in various businesses, five musicians, 30 students, many directors and workers in programs for the blind, and 61 housewives. At any other convention, there would be nothing at all remarkable about this broad cross-section of achievement and ability. It is exactly what you would have expected to find at any gathering of, say, the American Legion, or the Exalted Order of Elks or Masons, or at a town meeting in your home community. Anywhere else, that is to say, but a convention of the blind. It never ceases to surprise the public that a blind man may be able to hold his own in business, operate a farm successfully, argue a brief in a court of law, teach a class of sighted students, or conduct experiments in a chemistry lab. It comes as a shock to the average person to discover that the blind not only can, but do perform as well as the next man in all the normal and varied callings of the community. But this shock of recognition on the part of many people too easily gives way to a mood of satisfaction and an attitude of complacency. After all, if the blind are so capable, so successful, and so independent, what is the fuss all about? Where is the need for all this organization and all this militant activity? Why can't the blind leave well enough alone? These are reasonable questions and deserve a reasoned answer. I believe that the answer may best be given by reciting a list of some 16 specific events which have taken place recently in various parts of the country. The events are these. 1. A blind man, incidentally a distinguished educator and citizen in his community, was denied a room in a well-known YMCA in New York City. Why? Not on the ground that his appearance betokened inability to pay his bill. It did not. Not on the ground that he had an unsavory reputation, which he did not. Not on the ground that his behavior was or was likely to be disorderly, which I think it was not, but on the ground that he was blind. 2. A blind man was rejected as a donor in the blood bank in his city. Why? Not on the ground that his blood was not red. Not on the ground that his blood was watery, defective, and lacked corpuscles or was diseased. Not on the ground that he would be physically harmed by the loss of the blood, but on the ground that he was blind. 3. A blind man, incidentally a successful lawyer with an established reputation in his community, was denied the rental of a safety deposit box by a bank. Well, why? Not on the ground that he was a well-known bank robber. Not on the ground that he had nothing to put in it. Not on the ground that he couldn't pay the rental price. But on the ground, again, that he was blind. 4. A blind man was rejected for jury duty in a California city. Why? Not on the ground of mental incompetence, which incidentally I think was partly so, not on the ground of moral irresponsibility, not on the ground that he would not weigh the evidence impartially and come to a just verdict, but on the ground that he was blind. 5. A blind college student majoring in education was denied permission to perform practice teaching by a state university. Not on the ground that her academic record was poor, not on the ground that she had not satisfied the prerequisites, not on the ground that she lacked the educational or personal qualifications, but on the ground that she was blind. 6. A blind applicant for public employment was denied consideration by the Civil Service Commission of a state, and again, not on the ground that he lacked the educational or experience specifications, not on the ground that he was not of good moral character, not on the ground that he lacked the residence or citizenship requirements, but on the ground that he was blind. 7. A blind woman was refused a plane ticket by an airline. Not on the ground that she couldn't pay for her ticket, not on the ground that her heart was weak and she couldn't stand the excitement, not on the grounds that she was a carrier of contagion, but on the ground that she was blind. 8. A blind machinist was declared ineligible for a position he had already held for 5 years. This declaration was a result of a routine medical examination. It came on the heels of his complete clearance and reinstatement on the job following a similar medical finding the year before. These determinations were made not on the ground of new medical evidence showing that he was blind, for that was known all along and had been true for 5 years. Not on the ground that he could not do the job which he had successfully performed for 5 years with very high ratings. Not on the ground of any factor related to his employment. They were made on the ground that he was blind. 9. A blind high school student who was a duly qualified candidate for student body president was removed from the list of candidates by authority of the principal and faculty of the school. Not on the ground that he was an outside infiltrator from some other school, not on the ground that he was on probation, not on the ground that he was not loyal to the principles of the United States Constitution, but on the ground that he was blind. 10. A well-known insurance company, in its standard policy issued to cover trips on railroads, expressly exempts the blind from coverage. Why? Not on the ground that there is statistical or actuarial evidence that blind travelers are more prone to accidents than sighted travelers. Not on the ground that suitcases or fellow passengers fall on them more often. Not on the ground that trains carrying blind passengers are more likely to be wrecked. Unless, of course, it's the engineer who's blind. But solely on the ground of his blindness. Many, if not most, insurance companies, incidentally, either refuse to sell insurance to blind persons or charge them a higher premium. 11. A blind man who had been a successful justice court and police court judge in his community for 11 years, ran for the position of superior court judge in the general election of 1956 in a town in Northern California. During the campaign, his opponents did not argue that he was ignorant of the law and therefore incompetent, or that he had been guilty of bilking widows and orphans, or that he lacked the quality of mercy which it is said judges should have. Almost the only argument that they used against him was that he was blind. The voters, however, elected him handily. But follow this. At the next session of the state legislature, however, a bill was introduced disqualifying blind persons as judges. The organized blind of the state of California were able to modify this bill, but not to defeat it. 12. More than 60 blind men and women, among them doctors, teachers, businessmen, and members of various professions, were recently ordered by the Building and Safety Authority of a large city to move out of their hotel-type living quarters. This was not on the ground that they were pyromaniacs and likely to start fires, not on the ground that they were delinquent in their rent, not on the ground that they disturbed their neighbors with riotous living, but on the ground that as blind people, they were subject to the code provisions regarding, now get this, the bedridden, the ambulatory, and the helpless. That anyone who is legally blind must live in an institution-type building with all the rooms on the ground floor, with no stairs at the ends of the halls, with hard fireproof furniture, with chairs and all other equipment standing along the wall so that they won't fall over. 13. The education code of one of our states provides this: that deaf, dumb, and blind children may be sent at state expense to a school for the deaf, dumb, or blind outside of the state if they possess the following qualifications. 1, if they are free from offensive and contagious diseases. 2, if they have no parent, relative, guardian, or nearest friend able to pay for their education. 3, if by reason of deafness, dumbness, or blindness, they are not disqualified from being taught by the ordinary process of instruction and education. 14. In a recent opinion, the Supreme Court of one of the states held that a blind person who sought compensation for an injury due to an accident which he claimed arose out of and in the course of his employment by the State Board of Industries for the Blind, the court held that he was a ward of the state and therefore not entitled to compensation. The conception that blind shop workers are wards of the state was only overcome in another state by a recent legislative enactment. 15. A blind person, duly convicted of a felony and sentenced to a state penitentiary, was denied parole when he became eligible, therefore, not on the ground that he had not served the required time, not on the ground that his prison behavior had been bad, not on the ground that he had not been rehabilitated, but on the ground that he was blind. 16. A blind man, incidentally a member of this organization, who sat down at a gambling table in Reno, where such things are legal, was denied an opportunity to play, not on the ground that he didn't know the rules of the game, not on the ground that he might cheat the dealer or the other players, not on the ground that he didn't have any money to lose, which they proved, incidentally, but on the ground that he was blind. These last two cases, of course, show that the blind are normal in every respect. Now, what emerges from this set of events is the age-old stereotype of blindness as witlessness and helplessness. By virtue of this pervasive impression, a blind man is held to be incapable of weighing the evidence presented at a trial or performing the duties of a teacher. He cannot take care of himself in a room of his own. He is not to be trusted on a plane. A sightless person would not know what he had put into or taken out of a safety deposit box. And he has no right to employment in the public service. He must not even be permitted to continue in a job he has performed successfully for years. Even his blood cannot be given voluntarily for the common cause. Contrast these two lists, the lists of the members of the Federation attending the San Francisco Convention, and the list of discriminatory actions which I've just given you. The first is a list of accomplishments, of what the blind have done and therefore can do. The second is a list of prohibitions, of what the blind are thought incompetent to do and therefore are debarred from attempting. The first list refers to the physical disability of blindness. It demonstrates in graphic fashion how slight a disadvantage is the mere loss of sight to the mental capacity and vocational talent of the individual. The second list refers not to the disability, but to the handicap, which is imposed upon the blind by others. The origin of the disability is plainly inside the blind person. The origin and responsibility for the handicap are just as plainly outside him, in the attitudes and preconceptions of the community. It may be said that the discriminatory acts which I have cited, and others like them which are occurring all the time, simply do not reflect informed thought. They are occasional happenings, unpremeditated, irrational, accidental. Surely no one would justify them. No one would say that they represent an accurate appraisal of the blind and of blindness. Well, let's take a look at that. Let us look at pronouncements of presumably thoughtful and informed persons writing about the blind, agency heads, educators, administrators, social workers, historians, psychologists, and public officials. What do they have to say about the potentialities of the blind in terms of intellectual capacity, vocational talent, and psychological condition? What do they report concerning the prospects for social integration on the basis of normality and economic advancement on the basis of talent? First, an educator. Here are the words of a prominent authority on the education of the blind, himself for 30 years a superintendent of a school for the blind. It is wrong to start, says this gentleman, with the school and to teach there a number of occupations that the blind can do, but to teach them out of relation to their practical and relative values. This is equivalent to attempting to create trades for the blind and then, more or less angrily, to demand that the world recognize the work and buy the product, whether useful or useless. More than this, it is necessary to recognize the unfitness of the blind as a class for any sort of competition, and therefore to afford them not only protection but monopoly wherever possible. Declaring that it must be unqualifiedly conceded that there is little and in an industrial way that a blind person can do at all that cannot be done better and more expeditiously by people with sight. This expert considers that there are only two ways out, one being the extension of concessions and monopolies, and the other the designation of certain preferred occupations for the blind, leaving, as he says, the battle of wits only to those select few that may be considered and determined to be specially fit. The conclusion that employment possibilities are confined, with only negligible exceptions, to the purview of sheltered workshops is contained in this set of facts about the blind, which the same authority asserts to be generally conceded by those who have given the subject much thought. The handicrafts in which the blind can do first-class work are very limited in number, with basketry, weaving, knitting, broom and brush making, and chair caning as the most promising and most thoroughly tried out. That in these crafts, the blind cannot enter into direct competition with the seeing, either in the quality of product or the amount turned out in a given time. That the crafts pursued by the blind may best be carried on in a workshop under the charge of government officials or trained officers of certain benevolent associations, that among the higher callings, piano tuning and massage are, under favoring conditions, such as prevail for masseurs in Japan, the fields offering the greatest chance of success, while the learned professions, including teaching, are on the whole only for those of superior talent and, more particularly, of superior courage and determination to will it win at all costs. Second, an historian. The basis for this assessment and its justification has been presented in blunt and explicit language by a well-known historian of blindness and the blind in the United States. He makes this remarkable statement. There exists in the community a body of men who, by reason of a physical defect, namely the loss of sight, are disqualified from engaging in the regular pursuits of men, and who are thus largely rendered incapable of providing for themselves independently. They are to be regarded as disabled and infirm fraction of the people, or more specifically, as sighted men in a dark room. Rather than let them drift into absolute dependence and become a distinct burden, society is to lend an appropriate helping hand through the creation of sheltered, publicly subsidized employment. Third, an administrator. That this pessimistic appraisal of the range of talent among the blind has not been limited to the schoolmen and historians may be shown by two succinct statements from the wartime pamphlets produced by the Federal Civil Service Commission in an effort to broaden employment opportunities for the physically disabled. The blind, it was found, are especially proficient in manual occupations requiring a delicate sense of touch. They are well suited to jobs which are repetitious in nature. Again, the placement of persons who are blind presents very special problems. Small groups of physicians in sheltered environment involving repetitive work were surveyed in government establishments and were found to have placement potentialities for the blind. Such findings as these were doubtless at the base of a remark made by a certain public official who wrote that helping the blind has its strong appeal to the sensibilities of everyone. On the other hand, we should avoid making the public service an eleemosynary institution. Fourth, a blind agency head. The executive director of one of the largest private agencies for the blind justifies the failure of philanthropic groups in these blunt terms, quote, "The fact that so few workers or organizations are doing anything appreciable to improve the condition of the blind cannot be explained entirely on the grounds that these agencies are not in the vanguard of social thinking. It is rather because they are realistic enough to recognize that the rank and file of blind people have neither the exceptional urge for independence nor the personal qualifications necessary to satisfactory adjustment in the sighted world. It is very difficult and exceptional for a blind person to be as productive as a sighted person." Fifth, a psychologist. Even plainer language, as well as more impressive jargon, has been used by another authority who is widely considered the preeminent expert in the field of blind psychology. Quote, "Until recently," he writes, "the blind and those interested in them have insisted that society revise and modify its attitude towards this specific group. Obviously, for many reasons, this is an impossibility, and effort spent on such a program is as futile as spitting into the wind. It is extremely doubtful whether the degree of emotional maturity and social adaptability of the blind would long support and sustain any social change of attitude if it were possible to achieve it." If this is not plain enough, the writer continues, "A further confusion of attitude is found in educators and workers for the blind who try to propagandize society with the rational concept that the blind are normal individuals without vision. This desperate whistling in the dark does more damage than good. The blind perceive it as a hypercritical distortion of their true state, and society discovers it to be a misrepresentation of actual facts. It is dodging the issue to place the responsibility on the unbelieving and non-receptive popular attitudes. The only true answer," get this now, they're talking about you and me, "lies in the unfortunate circumstance that the blind share with other neurotics the non-aggressive personality and the inability to participate fully in society." There are two general directions for attacks upon such problems: either to adjust the individual to his environment, or to rearrange the environment so that he ceases to be a difficulty to the individual. It is quite obvious that the latter program is not only inadvisable, but also impossible. However, it is the attack that nearly every frustrated, maladjusted person futilely attempts. Six, a social worker. This sweeping negation of all attempts to modify the prejudicial attitudes of society towards the blind, however eccentric and extreme it may sound, finds strong support in the field of social casework. In areas where such ideas remain steadfast, reads a typical report, it is the function of the social caseworker to assist the blind person to work within these preconceived ideas. Since handicapped persons are a minority group in society, there is a greater possibility of bringing about a change in an individual within a stated length of time than there is in reversing accepted concepts within the culture. The well-adjusted blind person, it is argued, should be able to get along in this restrictive social setting, and the caseworker must concentrate on his personal adjustment, since it is easier to reform the client than to reform society. Seventh, a blind philanthropist. Let me close out my list of testimonials with one final citation. I think it must already be sufficiently obvious that, granting the assumptions contained in all these statements, the blind have no business organizing themselves apart from sighted supervision, that a social movement of blind, by the blind, for the blind, is doomed to futility, frustration, and failure. But just in case the point is not altogether clear, I offer the considered opinion of a well-known figure in the history of blind philanthropy. Quote, "It cannot, then, be through the all-blind society that the blind leader of the blind finds adequate opportunity for the exercise of his leadership. The wise leader will know that the best interests of each blind person lie within the keeping of the 999 sighted people who, with himself, make up each 1,000 of the average population. He will know further that if he wishes to promote the interest of the blind, he must become a leader of the sighted upon whose understanding and patronage the fulfillment of these interests depends. There is no advantage accruing from membership in an all-blind organization which might not be acquired in greater measure through membership in a society of sighted people." Well, what is the substance of all these damning commentaries? What are the common assumptions which underlie the attitudes of the leaders of blind philanthropy and the authorities on blind welfare? The fundamental concepts can, I think, be simply stated. First, the blind are, by virtue of their defect, emotionally immature, if not psychologically abnormal. They are mentally inferior and narrowly circumscribed in the range of their ability, and therefore inevitably doomed to vocational monotony, economic dependency, and social isolation. Second, even if their capabilities were different, they are necessarily bound to the fixed status and subordinate role ordained by society, whose attitudes towards them are permanent and unalterable. Third, they must place their faith and trust not in themselves and in their own organization, but in the sighted public, and most particularly in those of the sighted public who have appointed themselves the protectors and custodians of the blind. A few simple observations are in order. First, as to the immutability of social attitudes and discriminatory actions towards the blind, we know from intimate experience that the sighted public wishes well of the blind, and that its misconceptions are rather the result of innocence and superstition than of deliberate cruelty and malice aforethought. There was a time, in the days of Rome, when blind infants were thrown to the wolves or sold into slavery. That time is no more. There was a time in the Middle Ages when blind beggars were the butts of amusement at country fairs, decked out in paper spectacles and donkey's ears. That time is no more. There was a time, which still exists to a surprising extent, when the parents of a blind child regarded his disability as a divine judgment upon their own sins. But that time is now beginning to disappear, at least in the civilized world. The blind are no longer greeted by society with open hostility and frantic avoidance, but with compassion and sympathy. It is true that an open heart is no guarantee of an open mind. It is true that good intentions are not enough. It is true that tolerance is a far cry from brotherhood, and that protection and trusteeship are not the synonyms of equality and freedom. But the remarkable progress already made in the civilizing of brute impulses and the humanizing of social attitudes towards the blind is compelling evidence that there is nothing fixed or immutable about the social status quo for the blind, and that if the blind themselves are capable of independence and interdependence within society, society is capable of welcoming them. Our own experience as individual members of the National Federation gives support at short range to what long-range history already makes plain. We have observed and experienced the gradual breakdown of legal obstacles and prejudicial acts. We have participated in the expansion of opportunities for the blind in virtually every phase of social life and economic livelihood, in state, federal, and local civil service, in teaching and other professions, in the addition of a constructive element to public welfare. Let anyone who thinks social attitudes cannot be changed read this statement contained in a recent pamphlet of the Federal Civil Service Commission, which Archie quoted the other day. Sometimes a mistaken notion is held that the blind can do work only where keenness of vision is not important in the sighted job. The truth appears to be that the blind can do work demanding different degrees of keenness of vision on the part of the sighted. If there is any difference in job proficiency related to degree of keenness of vision required for the sighted, it is this. The blind appear to work with greater proficiency at jobs where the element of keenness of vision present to a noticeable extent in the sighted job than where vision is only generally useful. Compare that with what the Civil Service Commission said in its wartime pamphlets. Second, are the blind mentally inferior, emotionally adolescent, and psychologically disturbed? On the contrary, are they normal and capable of social and economic integration? The evidence that they are the latter can be drawn from many quarters, scientific, medical, and theoretical. But the evidence which is most persuasive is that I have already presented. It is the evidence displayed in the lives and performance of such average and ordinary blind men and women as those who attended our national convention last summer. It is the evidence of their vocational accomplishments, their personal achievements, the plain normality of their daily lives. To me, their record is more than an impressive demonstration. It is a clinching rebuttal. It would, of course, be a gross exaggeration to maintain that all blind persons have surmounted their physical disability and conquered their social handicap. It is not just then the education of the sighted only which is needed to establish the right of the blind to equality and integration. Just as necessary is the education of the blind themselves. For the process of their rehabilitation is not ended with physical and vocational training. It is complete only when they have driven the last vestige of the public stereotype of the blind from their own minds. In this sense, and to this extent only, is it true that the blind person must adjust to his handicap and to society. His adjustment need not, indeed must not, mean his submission to all prevailing social norms and values. His goal is not conformity, but autonomy, not acquiescence, but self-determination and self-control. From all this, it should be clear that it is a long way yet from the blind alleys of dependency and segregation to the main thoroughfares of personal independence and social integration, which we have set as our goal. I believe it is equally plain that our progress toward that goal will demand the most forceful and skillful application of all the means at our command. That is, the means of education, persuasion, demonstration, and legislation. We need the means of education to bring the public and the blind themselves to a true recognition of the nature of blindness. We need the means of education to bring the public and the blind themselves to a true recognition of the nature of blindness, to tear away the fossil layers of mythology and prejudice. We need persuasion to induce employers to try us out and to convince society to take us in. We need demonstration to prove our capacity and our normality in every act of living and of making a living. And finally, we need legislation to reform the statute books and obliterate the legal barriers which stand in the way of normal life and equal opportunity, replacing them with laws which accurately reflect the accomplishments and the knowledge of modern science and the ethics of democratic society. This final platform in our program of equality, the platform of adequate legislation, is in many respects the most crucial and pervasive and all important. For until the blind are guaranteed freedom of opportunity and endeavor within the law, there can be little demonstration of their ability and little prospect of persuasion. What is needed is nothing less than a new spirit of the laws, which will uproot the discriminatory clauses and prejudicial assumptions that presently hinder the efforts of the blind toward self-advancement and self-support. The new philosophy requires that programs for the blind be founded upon the social conception of their normality and the social purpose of their reintegration into the community, with aids and services adjusted to these conceptions. These, then, are the objectives of the self-organized blind, goals freely chosen for them by themselves. And this is the true significance of an organization of the blind, by the blind, for the blind. For the blind, the age of charity, like the age of chivalry, is dead. But that is not to say that there is no place for either of these virtues. In order to achieve the equality that is their right, in order to gain the opportunity that is their due, in order to attain the position of full membership in the community that is their goal, the blind have continuing need for the understanding and sympathy and liberality of their sighted neighbors and fellow citizens. But their overriding need is, first of all, for recognition of themselves as normal and of their purpose as legitimate. The greatest hope of the blind is that they may be seen as they are, not as they have been portrayed. And since they are neither wards nor children, their hope is to be not only seen but also heard in their own accents and for whatever their cause may be worth.